Hey, welcome back everybody to my podcast. And today's episode is brought to you by ProBalls.com. As you know, ProBalls.com is a statistical platform where you can follow players, follow leagues, follow teams. And today with Micah Shrewsbury, my guest from Notre Dame head coach, we analyzed the box score of the final game of the season against Wake Forest. And he shared his opinion on what he looks for, particularly for his team. And besides that, we also talked a lot about his time with the Celtics when he was an assistant coach there and the lessons he learned that he learned to apply in his current job, also as a head coach, as an assistant coach in college. The struggles he sees that other assistant coaches are dealing with, the mentorship and the companionship amongst other head coaches, exchanging frustrations, exchanging emotions. We talked about tactics. We talked about spacing. We talked also about the players itself and how to reach them, how to relay information and the attention span and how to shorten up the information to make it more precise. A lot of those things that are also interesting, I think, for players, for assistant coaches, for up and coming head coaches. So please tune in to this one. Please tune in into the coming episodes. There's a lot more coming. Subscribe to this podcast if you enjoyed it. Also share with colleagues, with friends, and with anybody who you think could learn something from it. Thanks for being here and see you soon again. Bye. Micah, what's up, my man? Good to see you here. Welcome to my world.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, it's a very specific world here over in Europe, and my viewership, my listeners, you're a first college coach, so it's going to be interesting for them to hear a different perspective and just a different view of things, especially with your experiences. So I am really looking forward to that.
Yeah, I hope I can provide something here of substance.
For sure. Not even a question. It's just a matter of me squeezing it out of you. That's the bigger. that's my other talent that I'm gonna try to make use of today. Before we dive into it, sometimes I prepare four quarters, but sometimes I prepare two halves. And since I'm talking to a college coach, I'm gonna prepare two halves. The first half is gonna be more NBA versus college, since you were 6 years with us with the Celtics,
yes,
right?
6 years. Yeah.
And then the second part will be more about the college part, college game and the coaching staffs and what you expect. But before we dive into that, I was wondering, I was a coach's son as well. And I know what it feels like to be coached by your father. And so I was wondering, how do you balance that role of being a father and a coach and then having that day-to-day interaction? And, you know, and there's always a fine line to dance, and depending on who's around, maybe who's not around. I'm just wondering, what's your approach and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, it was actually the first time I've ever done it. You know, I've never coached either of my boys before. I've just, you know, we work out and we do things, but I've never coached them. And yeah. It was, you know, it was challenging at first, because, like, you know, one, like, you obviously you want to make sure, like, you're not playing favorites, right? Or not showing favoritism. And sometimes that resulted in me getting on him more than anything. So that, like, you know, when he was doing good things, and that's, you know, talking to a lot of people beforehand, I made sure that the assistant coaches spent a lot of time coaching him, and not me. Like, and I did, like, I coached him like anybody else, but, you know, there's some built in kind of things that, you know, were just different in a father son relationship that I wanted to kind of eliminate. And then he put a lot of pressure on himself, right? Because he wanted to prove that he did belong here. And he wasn't just here just because of, you know, who he was or who his dad was. Mm-hmm. So I think once he got through that part of it, kind of once we got used to each other and being around each other on a daily basis in a highly stressed situation, things got good as the season went on.
It can also help your bond going forward. You know, it's just the way that you start dealing with each other in a different level, you know, and that also, like you said, there's this part of peer pressure, you know, that comes with it. As you said, it's you like how are my teammates viewing me and what's the perception of things. But then also, you know, that balance from your side is very important. And I remember I was playing before I went to the States. I was playing for my father's just in small on the youth teams a little bit. But then when I came back as a professional, I played for him, and that was a different thing. You know, as a professional, you have certain expectations, especially when you're coming in. I would say it was a semi-professional team because there was like four players in the beginning that were just still working part-time jobs. But in general, when you are signed as a professional, there's a different pressure that comes with it, especially then when the father is also under pressure as a professional coach. And that was playing some mind games sometimes, but it took a while to get through it. And then once you're through it, you find, you know, your friends, you learn that they're looking at you as a normal player, you know, as your peers become your friends anyway. And the teammates just going to support you more than anything normally.
Yeah. I think the one thing that really helped him is he's like a maniacal worker, right? So like he, you know, I would put him up against anybody, right? Like not just on our team, like anybody across the country of like, I'm not sure there's very many guys that work harder than he works. And I think everybody sees that and recognizes that like, okay, this isn't like, there's no favoritism. Like this dude is earning what he's getting. And I think that helps. So like, he earned the respect and trust of his teammates, and that part was very important.
Yep. All right, let's dive into you going, because we can't talk about the whole career, right? That's mean we might as well write a book. But in terms of going from MBA to college and the lessons you learned that you could implement right away, do you remember something specifically that you was like, there was an aha moment when you went from an assistant coach role to an assistant coach role and you kind of had a perception or the lessons you learned with being an NBA locker room that you could carry on to a college locker room?
Yeah. Getting to the NBA was like such a eye-opening moment for me as a coach. And, you know, I always say like, you don't know what you don't know. And I had coached for a long time in college, and it was great. So, you know, Brad and I, in the first few days while we're there, and we were lucky to have Ron Adams as an assistant coach. And we had all these ideas of things that we had done in college, and like, we're trying to go through them on the court. And Ron's like, that'll never work. Like, no, that's not going to work at all. That's not going to work at all. And like, it was so eye-opening. And so like I learned so much during that time, during those 6 years, that I had never even thought of before, just because, you know, you're basketball full time. And like now to go from there and then go back to college and talk about small things like spacing, like we weren't, excuse me, we weren't talking about spacing at all in college before I went to the NBA. Like just little things that we try and implement, you know, with our screening angles, with how we're attacking certain coverages, with, you know, what we're doing defensively and having tweaks with, you know, for different personnel. Like none of those things were even thought about. And like, I feel like coming back, like I have such a greater amount of knowledge to try and use for not only our coaching staff, but also our players to help them become better.
Yeah, the spacing aspect is very, especially in Europe also, the spacing is such a big thing of where you put the players in the corner, or when you have them cut along the baseline, or just kind of confuse the help, because it's more about the defenders than it's more about the offense, right? So you got to worry about where the defense is going to stand and how you move your players around to make the defense a little bit, you know, think a little bit more on that end.
But no, absolutely. Yeah. You're right about that. And like that's, you know, we were more I guess, more system-based in college, where you know, you're just running a system, where you're not thinking of how people are guarding you, where the help is coming from, and how do you manipulate the help? I think that's where you're starting to see some people kind of study it more and tweak it more a little bit now in college. People are starting to try and do it more.
I remember when I was playing in college, and then I compared myself when I later, and especially to now, I play with a tunnel vision in terms of not seeing the game. You just kind of, like you said, you're executing a system. You execute in place because the coach is drilling you of executing the play. And you're not even thinking about the defense as much. You're just kind of running through the angles and the screens. And also, what made me think of it was the game. Did you feel a difference in game when pre-NBA time, let's say 2005 through 2013 in college, to after you came back from the NBA to college? Was there a difference in game? Because I felt like from what I saw, that the college game changed over the last 15 years. There's been a bit more. Go ahead, you say it, and I'll say what I saw.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you know, I think everybody tries to mimic like different things, right? They start to see. I think the college game is years behind the NBA game. So whatever they see people doing that they're having success in, and you know, people in the NBA do it as well. Like if people are having success, then they try and mimic that. Well, college is the same thing, but it's like a few years behind. So like, I mean, there were things, and this is crazy, that like we were running almost like a ball screen continuity offense at Butler, like in 2000 and, you know, 8 to 10 or 11 when we were there. And now a lot of people are really starting to do it now in college. And it's like so funny that, like, you know, things are behind a little bit, where now, like, if you watch more NBA now, off ball movement is coming back in vogue a lot more, where now you'll see that in college maybe 3 to 4 years down the line.
And it did feel like, that's what you said, the ball screen continuity and ball screen action in general just went up a notch in college. And it's way more than, because I remember it used to be way more screening actions, off ball flex actions, whatever you want to, you know, whatever you, however you want to move the defense around. Not so much pick and roll play. And now it is more ball handling, more pick and roll. That's where the spacing comes into play. And then you kind of have to think about the spacing more of the other players involved or not involved in the pick and roll.
Yeah, it's really changing. You're seeing that a lot more. And now, like, you know, people are thinking about those different tweaks now.
How did you improve as a coach when you became a head coach? And you feel now you go back the last years, and like what were the biggest jumps you made as a head coach? If you reflect on your career so far.
Yeah. I think for me is, and this is funny, I always talk about, so I was a NAIA head coach in like 2005. And I always talk about that because like, I was in a rush to be a head coach, and I got there and I was like, man, I have no idea like what I'm doing. Right. Like I didn't know who I wanted to be. Right. And, and it took me, going back to other college programs and then going to the NBA and now getting a second chance when I went to Penn State, where like I'm comfortable with, you know, kind of who I am, kind of how we want to play, but I'm comfortable not being in control of everything, right? Like, you know, we play a lot of different styles. Like we play a lot of five out. We do a lot of splits. We'll play a lot of pick and roll. But then like we'll hunt matchups. And that's, you know, one thing in the NBA that we're doing. And like, we had a lot of success with it at Penn State because we had really smart players that understood. They were all on the same page about how to get an advantage, then how to, you know, keep an advantage once we got it. And, you know, sometimes doing that, it's out of your hands as a coach. Like I don't really control every possession. And I'm okay with that, right? I'm okay with these guys making decisions. And I think that's where, like, I've learned to really, like, help these guys see the game, and then allow them to play, and then give my inputs as needed, you know, at different times throughout the games to talk about what I see and how it matches up with what they see to get the best advantages for our team.
So that's interesting, because that it brings up my mind is working as you're talking, because I rushing into becoming a head coach is a good cue, I think, for my listeners also, because there's a lot of coaches that are eager to become a head coach without having matured as a person. In general, like you said, you need some patience to give control, to give up control. You need to have some life experience as well to know who you are and feel secure about yourself making that decision, leaving that up, empowering the players basically to make those decisions on the court, kind of helping them, preparing them for those situations that they may face in that, you know, bending the defense and then making the right reads along the way. But when you became a head coach, did you feel that now, like after the NBA, And later on, but what did you think of when you think back of become when you were an assistant coach? Did you feel like, man, as an assistant, I should have done this and should have done that? Did you reflect back where you could have done a different job as an assistant coach to prepare the head coach and help the head coach in different ways?
I don't think so. Right. Mm-hmm. Like now I was lucky as well. Right. I've worked for. You know, as most of my time as an assistant coach, you know, I've worked for Brad Stevens for 10 years, and I worked for Matt Painter for 4 years. And I left the NBA I left Butler. I went to Purdue, and Coach Painter, like, is one of the most humble coaches. He's a great coach, but he's also really humble, and he allowed me to have a lot of input on things that we were doing when we were at Butler. Same when I came from the Celtics to Purdue, like he let me really run with a lot of things. Like, hey, offensively, what were some of the hardest things for you guys to guard? Like, let's run that. Like, he gave up a lot of, he gave up a lot of control, mm-hmm. and allowed me to really help him become a better coach, which was, it was helping me at the same time. So I was lucky in that way, right? Like I was everything, like my whole role as an assistant coach is like, how do I make this program better? And how do I make this head coach better? And if you just focus on that, I think you're having success. If you're allowed, you still got to speak your mind and still got to have some input, but you also got to know it's not your team, right? Like, you got to prepare for when you have your own team, but it's not your team. And you got to do with what that head coach wants you to do. But if you get lucky enough to have a guy that seeds some control and allows you to do more, like that's where it's like you're growing at the same time. And I was fortunate to grow.
And I think that's a huge issue in Europe, I would say, because a lot of coaches are not willing to give up control to their assistant coaches. There are some that push their assistant coaches that are more forward-thinking because they also know that those assistant coaches will feel empowered and confident, and they will help you in turn because they feel confident. You know, if you just put them in the corner and have them do video work and not talk or just have random situations where the coach head coach is controlling everything, the assistant coaches may have brilliant ideas. They're just not going to bring them up or not going to feel confident about their ideas because they never had that voice. So I think it's a huge, that brings me to mentorship also, because I think it's important to have for coaches to have coaching mentors. And I'm wondering if you, because I hear voices talking to a lot of coaches that are not able to exchange their frustration with other coaches within their fraternity, you know, that there is some, not necessarily insecurity, but there is some of that, but also some fear that it might be used against you. So how important and how present is it to have friends within the coach's fraternity around where you can exchange ideas and kind of vent or open up and kind of let your frustration be known, because it's naturally come up and you have to be able to vent to somebody.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Like you have, you know, whether that's people you were with, people that you kind of have gone through the business with, like, you know, there's so many people that are going through the same things. Mm-hmm. And I think being able to share ideas, even in a competitive but non-competitive way, like continuing to try and grow, but also to have people that, you know, you can talk about what's happening with you, right? And that's, you know, I've been fortunate in that way. Like, there's a bunch of guys that are kind of, that I kind of grew up with around, like, at the same age as me, you know, from Indiana guys from college that are now coaching, that, you know, we're now kind of experiencing things at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. I think, like, you know, a guy like Dusty May at Michigan now, who's a good friend that, like, from high school, that now he's taking this job. And even though we're competitors, like, I'm trying to help him the best that he can navigate getting through, you know, his situation that I just went through last year. So, like, I think even guys that you're competing with, being able to be open with people, you know, yeah, that, like, sure, you might think somebody's going to use something against you, but it also, like, if you have a circle that you trust, you know, have that group that you can share ideas with, that you can share frustrations with, but you guys can kind of grow together.
Yeah, that's the thing, that you go way back, you know, you grew up together, and then there's a more sense of just more friendship than colleagues. You know, there's a little bit, it goes a long way. And I think in the business, a lot of coaches, if they didn't have that in the past, it's kind of hard to find that relationship with somebody, some of your competitors, to find that trust. I'm leaning more towards oversharing and letting my frustrations, my emotions be known. And then, you know, if it's going to be used against me, so be it. You know, it's just kind of, it's kind of, it is what it is. I feel like I'm still in control, and I want to be true to who I am, you know, as a person, first of all. And that's, I think, a lot of times coaches are a little bit more reluctant to open up and share their emotions with their colleagues, where in turn it could help both sides.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, like you were saying, if you have that, like, you know, you have to have an outlet somewhere, right? Like, you know, keeping all that frustration in or whatever it may be, it's not going to be healthy for you. So you need a healthy outlet every once in a while. And, and it's, you also know, like, as you're going through it, you kind of know who that person can be and who it can't be as well.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
There's been guys, like, in league and conferences that's like, man, I don't trust this dude not one bit. Like, I'm never going to say anything to that person. But there's other people, like, there are good people out there.
Yeah,
and, like, find the good people that you can kind of connect with in different ways, to just so you get that outlet.
Exactly. Yeah. It's intuition that comes into play. And I feel a lot of times it's also that both are waiting who's going to be the first one to open up, you know, and then you're kind of like, okay, I got somebody. it just kind of tense and waiting for that. Communication. That's a big factor for me. And I know with Brad, that's also one of the biggest things in terms of choosing your words wisely and being very precise with it and to the point. And I was wondering what were the communication lessons that you learned when talking with NBA players versus college players? Like, what do NBA players value in terms of communication versus what the college players value?
Yeah, it's so different, right? Like, with those guys, and, like, you know, one of the greatest lessons that you think about is, you know, and Brad always talked about this, like, use, like, Rajon Rondo. And then he was in Boston for a long time, but, like, you know, he had been coached by Doc Rivers, who was a great coach before us, like, and Aaron Baines, who had played in college for Tony Bennett, who's a really good coach, and then went to the Spurs and then played for Greg Popovich, right? Like, I think in college, you get guys that they're just, hey, you're the coach, and I'm going to listen to what you say, right? Like, when you get to the NBA, these guys have been coached by some really good coaches, right? Especially guys that have moved around or a little bit older. So I think in your message that you have for them, you know, the best thing is, like, you have to let them know that you're prepared and here is why we're doing this. And then you also got to be okay with them coming back at you, right? Mm-hmm. And having, you know, some kind of give and take. But if you're strong enough and you've researched everything, you've done the work, you feel confident in it, you can handle the back and forth. And then when they see that's like, yeah, okay, he's prepared with this, then they'll get on board with you 100%. Mm-hmm. But if you're not 100% like right, or if you're not 100% confident in that, then there it's going to be hard for them to get on board with what you're saying. Whereas in college, like, they're just going to do it, right? You're the coach and you're supposed to, like, they might question you like in the locker room afterwards, but like, yeah, nobody question what your game plan is going into that.
Yeah, the experience matters. And that's it's humbling at the same time. And you got to be able to communicate that properly to the NBA players, I imagine, to not seem overly, you know, overly powerful, but be a humble, it has to be a humble conversation where you also are willing to receive information. And like you said, having a back and forth, because there's going to be counter arguments naturally. And the more you can make a valid point and justify why you're doing things in the proper tone and manner, you know, without being authoritative, because those guys have been through a lot, and especially the older the guys are, the more they want to have a normal conversation. And yeah, it also raised the question for me, and how do you balance being a serious professional but also remaining your human side, you know, just not giving up that your personality and being authentic without losing your authority. And there's a fine line also that has to be danced in the NBA, I can imagine.
No, there definitely is. And I think the human side allows them to be able to relate with you, but be able to open up with you a little bit more as well. Right? And that's like, you know, the most important thing is like, hey, you got to show them that you are like, you know, you're super detailed and you're super prepared for this, right? This role, these situations. But then you also got to show them that like you have their best interests at heart, but also the teams. And I think, you know, sometimes those lines kind of get crossed, especially at the professional level. So like, hey, both of these things can happen, right? Like, this can be successful for you, and this can be successful for our team. Getting that message across in your own way, I think, like, you know, those guys will sniff out when you're not being authentic. Mm-hmm. Like, if you can get that message across authentically in your own way, I think that's, you know, the part right there that can really allow you to get under the hood with some of these guys, where you build those relationships where they trust you and trust what you're saying.
Yeah, it's also that criticism comes into play. Also, speaking the truth and speaking it in the way where it's not disrespectful, but it's also you trying to grow together. You know, like I said, like grow for him to help to grow, and then for the team at the same time to grow. And then that's when the players also feel like they're getting better. They can trust you at the same time, help the team. And there's also a fine line of how to relay the criticism, right? And make them feel comfortable with that voice, your voice, your authentic voice.
Yeah, I think there's times for it as well. Like, you know, when you have to give the criticism, and mm-hmm. when that happens, like, you know, it may be different for each person, right? Your relationships may be different, but some people it might be right away, right up front. But like, that's hard to do. It's hard to give somebody that criticism right away, and they don't know you, and they don't know like mm-hmm. your intentions and everything else. So like, how do you gain that trust to be able to give them those hard truths when they need it? And I think that's the one thing, like, and I've, you know, it's really helped in professional basketball, but it's helped in college, is like, I give our guys the truth and hard truths, but they also know that I care about them. Mm-hmm. So I can give them that, you know, the whatever they need, I can say it to them, but they know I care about them first. And if they didn't know that, and I was just, you know, constantly going after them with, you know, with getting after them all the time, then, you know, they're going to bail on you quick.
Yeah. Yeah. There has to be a balance. It's always has to be a balance. Another thing came up that now, just as we talked about it during that process, when you said when player is going to share with you, with the assistant coach in the NBA, share certain information or share certain thoughts. How did you filter that of what you bring back to the head coach and what you don't bring back to the coach? Because, you know, like the head coach doesn't have to know everything. Like it has to be a filter, because assistant coaches are usually the filters. So how did you differentiate of what needs to be relayed and what doesn't?
Yeah, that's the, you know, it's not a hard, like, you know, it's not a hard choice, but sometimes those are the toughest choices of like, what, you know, what do you relay? What's important, right? Because like, you don't want it to affect the relationship between the player and the head coach.
Yes.
You also don't want it to affect the head coach's judgment. Right. Like, you know, everybody's complaining about something, like every single person, whether I'm the best player on the roster or the last person on the roster, I'm complaining about something. But if I'm closer to, you know, one of the last, maybe I'm in the middle and I'm complaining about something, right? Like that could affect the head coach's judgment on, if it's even between two guys and like whether I play one guy or the other, like what that is, like that's where you got to make the choice of like, I don't want to affect the coach's judgment just because this guy is complaining about something that maybe is not even very important.
Right.
Right.
So yeah.
You got to choose like what's going to be detrimental to the team and what can be handled without the head coach even knowing, so it doesn't affect our team, right?
Nice.
If somebody's complaining about something that's going to be detrimental to our team, then you probably got to let the head coach know, right? And that way it doesn't affect the play on the court. But if it's not going to have any effect on it, then you just got to sit there sometimes and listen and accept it and make sure this guy, like, understands like what, you know, you're trying to relay what the head coach is thinking and how that fits, and then handle it yourself. And if he's still going to be able to go out and do his job that night.
Yeah. And at the same time, you don't want to lose face with the player. You know, you don't want to lose the respect level to the player, because he's going to sniff it out that you told him, you know, if the head coach lets the emotions get the better of him and he doesn't hold back, that the player is going to put two and two together. You know, so that's another balancing act. I think there it's important for coaches to understand of, and it's a good thing, like you said, like if it's not detrimental to the team and if it's just, you don't want to impact the coach's judgment. That's the point. I think that's a big takeaway. So I'm going to share my screen real quick with you, because I want my ProBallers.com sponsor to have this segment as well and have their moment of one shining moment. So you should be able to see it here. Can you see the ProBallers.com?
Yes, sir.
All right. And here recently this year they added, last year, I believe they added the college teams. So people can watch college teams. They can follow college teams. They can favorite players, and they can follow certain players to their statistics, their performances throughout the year. And we're going to go to the Fighting Irish and go straight to the pain and go to the last game, the box score. And just to have an idea of what's the first thing that comes to mind when you look at the box score, and what do you look for? We don't have a halftime box score right now, but what do you usually look for? What are three indicators for you for the team's success?
Yeah, and you know, this was late in the year, but how we play is really important for us, right? We're like we This year, we were a really good defensive team. There's been other years where we've been great offensively, but like what stood out for our team, one, like we were a high turnover team this year. And we weren't an overly big team where like we weren't like a huge, we weren't a huge offensive rebounding team all the time, right? So I always looked at our rebounds, our offense rebounds, and our turnovers to try and see, like, gave us a good feel of, are we winning the possession battle, right? We needed to get more possessions than the other team. We weren't a great shooting team. So, we needed to try and win the possession battle so we got more possessions than them. So going in and looking at turnovers right away, looking at offensive rebounds, how many offensive rebounds are we giving up? Like, you know, I always look at that to see what our possessions are. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you have a pretty good feel for your shooting. Like we weren't a great shooting team. So this, you know, these guys gave us problems in this game with our shooting, and they took away some stuff from us and made it really hard for us to score. But I always go right away to the possessions. That's the first thing I look at is the possessions and how are we doing? Are we getting more shots than them? Are they getting more shots than us? And then you have a sense for how the game is really kind of going.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. It's now it's the possession. The possession battle is probably the big priority in on every team, on every game. I think a lot of coaches are looking for that. And the point I think that also is important here is that you are very specific to your team's weaknesses or the things that you are putting emphasis on throughout the whole year, throughout the practices, and then you can emphasize that and just kind of reiterate or just move on to other things.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's kind of your group, and you are what you emphasize. Mm-hmm. And if we can go in talking about winning possessions, having more possessions than them, being more efficient in our possessions, I think the better we'll be on both ends of the court.
Yep. All right, everybody, ProBalls.com. Check it out when you have a minute. And you can follow players, follow teams, and enjoy the process. Don't forget that. So going to the college, which we already covered a lot because it just kind of bleeds into each other, I think. But talking about new now as a head coach, what are your expectations from your assistant coaches after being through the grinder in the last years? But what's the expectation you have for your assistant coaches during games? What do you want them to look for? And then in practices, what do you usually assign them with?
Yeah. And that's, still being a fairly young head coach, I think that's, kind of the balance for me that I'm still trying to figure out. In practices, like, I want to give these guys a chance to develop their voices, right? Have input on what we're doing. So we do a lot of breakdown drills. And I kind of like, hey, here's what I would like to get accomplished in this, but I'm not going to tell you how to do it, right? And I want them to be creative in what they do, be creative in thought of how to come up with something that best fits our game plan, that helps our guys get better. That gets the point across, but it allows teaching time as well where they're talking and communicating. I think that was something that was really big for me as a coach was, kind of developing my voice. How do I want to implement something? How do we want to do it? How do we want to break it down? I think that's something that's, I try to be intentional of with our assistant coaches to get them a lot of time doing that. In games, it's different. I think, we don't chart a lot of stuff like in game. Like, I don't have those guys charting because I think they miss the kind of back and forth in what they're doing, right? I want them to be locked into the game. I want them to see the flow of the game where sometimes if you're writing something down, you miss something, you don't know what happened. Like, I want them to be locked into what's happening and having different ideas about how we can improve, how we can change. things like that. But, you know, like I said, I'm still a young head coach, so sometimes I don't always listen during those times.
But that's a huge thing, feeling the flow of the game. It's such a huge thing, underrated, because a lot of coaches also in Europe, they have you chart every little thing. At one point, I remember my early on, I was charting the offense, our plays, the efficiency of our plays, and then at the same time charting deflections that our team was doing on the defensive end. So you just kind of offense, defense, and you just right. At the end of the day, you see the efficiency of your plays, of it breaks down. You know, you go to one on one, post, perimeter, and then at some point, like what was the game like? Where did we lose in the rebounding battle? Is that, are we too small? You know, that you miss out on the little nuances on that gray matter. I think that's really, a lot of times, makes a difference.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, there might be a couple guys that are charting. We have a couple of kind of guys that are in non-coaching roles on our staff that are they may be charting some different things. That we may talk about, you know, different kind of possessions, like maybe one's doing offense, one's doing defense, and they're, you know, coming into halftime and telling us like maybe our defensive runs and how they were happening, things like that. But for the most part, I want most of our guys, like I said, kind of focusing on the flow of the game.
Yeah, just take small notes. Maybe just have little thoughts.
Small notes here or there that like I can write down at a dead ball of like, hey, we gotta bring this up, or we gotta talk about this at the next timeout, or they're running this action and it keeps bothering us. Like, how do we guard this, or how do we, you know, figure out a way to stop this?
Mm-hmm. And do you manage the load for the assistant coaches? Is that like I remember was. And on different staffs, we had a lot of meetings. You know, and there's at some point there's a echelon where you just like there's nothing more to learn here, and let's not keep talking about the same thing in circles. You just go back to square one. At some point, you gotta make a decision, and then the 80-20 rule that I currently apply to everything in my life, 80-20 rule, and you can apply it anywhere. And I feel like if it's 80%, okay, like you deal with the 20% along the way. So you just kind of at some point also manage it's time management, but also energy management. I can imagine, because the discussion fatigue, the ideas, you know, to keep flowing, at some point there's a limit reached.
Yeah. We I'm probably pretty rare in this that we don't meet a lot. You know, it's just, I may be working for Brad and then working for Coach Painter. They're like completely opposite, where we used to meet a lot with Coach Painter and Brad. Like, we rarely met. Like, so we meet to make sure we're all on the same page, to get, you know, our game plan down or our practice plan down. And then here's how we need it. But I want to give these guys time to figure it out too. Like, hey, I try and meet to give them time to plan the segment that they're going to do in practice. Mm-hmm. Right. So I don't want it rushed. I don't want them to feel rushed. So like if I can get that done, if I can get the practice plan done early in the day, then we can meet about it and then give them time to plan like how they want to do their segments or what mm-hmm. they want to talk about in those segments. But sometimes people are just meeting to meet, like, you know, like I trust what they're doing and I trust our guys, and part of putting a staff together is hiring good people and allowing them to work and allowing them to work and do what they do, do what they do best, because I think everybody's schedules are different, right? Everybody's, especially here in college, everybody's in different stages of life too.
Yep.
Right. We got a couple of young guys that are single that could be here all day. We got a couple of guys that are a little bit older that have kids that have responsibilities. So maybe they get here earlier in the day and are morning people, where, you know, if I'm a single guy, I could be there all night. It's no rush to leave. So like, having everybody on the same schedule or meeting schedule or whatever, like, you know, you got to understand like who people are and what stages of life they are in too, which, you know, allows them to be the most efficient that they can be.
Yeah. And happy happy life, happy job. I mean, happy life, happy wife, happy life, happy life, happy job. You know, like you got to balance all those things, and then it's going to bleed into each other for sure. The one thing that I also just came to my mind, because the pre-MBA era for you and the post-MBA era for you, did you notice a difference in attention span of players in terms of how much information they can absorb? Because we talked about the preparation process that you do, you know, for the scouting reports, for you know, when you have the meetings and what you want to relay to the team, you got to filter it down. Has it changed over that span of years, and you notice a difference in terms of how efficient and how precise the information has to be, and the information load has to be a little bit less than it used to be?
Yeah, I've definitely noticed it. Yeah. It is a difference. And you have to be really intentional with the information that you're giving them and what you want them to retain, right? Like, because they're not remembering everything. Mm-hmm. You're also not going to have them for a long period engaged. So, like, you got to be really precise with what you give them. And you got to be quick and precise with how you deliver it. If not, they're going to miss stuff, right? So, like, what's the most important thing? That's probably, for me, like, preparation-wise, like, a lot of studying. Like, I try and study, if I can, the best ways that our guys learn.
Each individual.
Each individual, yeah. And then we try and hit them in different ways. So maybe a guy's better in an individual setting. So, like, I can't change, you know, what we do. We're still going to meet as a team, but maybe somebody's going to grab him individually and go through these things because he's going to learn it better that way than sitting with the entire group. Some guys are better walking through. Some guys are better learning through film, right? Mm-hmm. Like, trying to really get under the hood with those guys to see the best way that they learn and then deliver the timely kind of aspects of game plan or learning or whatever it is, like delivering that in a kind of succinct way, or like they're you're going to lose them after a short amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah. There are some guys that are visual learners, some guys are readers. They're like they do, and I think it's a very good point that to differentiate and have reach everyone individually. And then as a team, when you present it, you just kind of have to paint the big picture to make them understand what your goals are, like the top three goals for this team, for this game is boom, 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 just the bullet points. And then, as you say, at some point, you just got to trust them. You just got to let it go.
Yeah. Yeah. That's going into every game, I try and give them a couple of short bullet points that's going to describe the team we're playing. So, you know, hey, they are here, and I might do it in numbers. Sometimes they may not understand analytics, but everybody knows numbers and what's greater and what's not very good, right? Mm-hmm. So I may give them, hey, this team is getting this percentage of offensive rebounds, right? And like compare that to the rest of, hey, the rest of the country gets 10% on average. This team is getting 15%. Like, paint the picture where it's like great or not good in like short ways, where now they can go from the very first film session to say, okay, I can name three things that this team does really good. And this is how we'll beat them.
It's just like the extremes, you know, like this is that they do this great, like the opposite ends of the spectrum. And you just want to point out the biggest things that they, I got
yep.
you. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know this is maybe a touchy subject, so you can feel free. Just, we can skip over this in terms of recruitment. And like, are there certain information or certain things that you are looking for when you are recruiting a kid, in terms of personal life, in terms of what are the key things, key components for you to see that this is a kid that you want on your program?
Yeah, that it's, you know, we're in like a unique setting where, you know, at Notre Dame, we have huge academic standards, right? So like, you know, that's going to narrow our pool right away. Like, mm-hmm. you know, there's half the people can't get into school here. So like, we got to understand that first and foremost, who can can't get into school. And then from there, like for me, like I start looking at system fits. And then like, I really like I'm a competitor. I got to find guys that are just like me. Right. So I got to find guys that love basketball and guys that are competitors. And like, I guess I could take you if you're not a competitor, but it's going, I don't know if you can, you can't really change that. Right. You just have to, I guess, be okay with it. Yep. Knowing it going in. If you get a guy that's not super competitive. So, you know, I kind of look at those things first and foremost. And then, you know, from there we try and like get to the character side of it. Right. Like, you know, I love to sleep. Like I want to go to bed at night, not worrying about, you know, if somebody's burning the dorms down. Right. Like, we're all like, I made mistakes when I was a kid too, but like, so yeah, the young guys are going to make mistakes, but like, if I can find some high character guys, that kind of fit into our team culture, I'm going to search that out and value that a little bit more. But I value that competitiveness. I think it's a kind of lost, with today's kind of kids, I think that gets lost a lot. And, I'm a value a competitor, you know, like just like you would value shooting.
Yeah. No, the competitive part is ingrained. Either you have it or you don't. And you see it right away when you watch guys live. You see it in their eyes. You know, are they on fire? Are they just going through it? Or what's the, you know, it jumps out at you immediately. And does international, like how is international now the international market impacting recruiting? How do you view that?
Yeah, it's for us. Like I haven't, I think we could really use the international market, right? At a school like Notre Dame, I think we could. You know, we didn't do it much when I was at Penn State. I didn't think it was a kind of, I don't know if we were valued in the same light as there. So, but here is a place where I think like we could really, really use the international market, right? Because of, you know, we have a brand that reaches over there, but also style of play. And what I'm looking for is already going to be ingrained. Guys that know how to play, guys that are skilled, guys that are pretty tough, guys that play kind of a free-flowing style, like that's the international game would blend very closely with how we want to play here. So like we're very open to trying to recruit, you know, internationally.
Yeah, it seems like there's a bigger emphasis each year on international, and also in terms of I see that coaches coming over, and it's always been like that. But it kind of feels like it's bit by bit it's stepping up. So, especially because of, you know, the NIL money, everything is changed. It changed the whole market. But that's for another conversation. are you ready for my ATOs? I usually ask my guests some ATOs at the end. I just have some bullet points or quick questions, right? Drawn up quick play, and you answer it. What the first thing that comes to mind? Okay. Favorite non-basketball Twitter follow.
Oh wow. Non-basketball Twitter follow. I don't know if I follow anybody that's non-basketball Twitter followers.
the top basketball follow.
Ryan Pannone obviously is a good one. Like he puts out a lot of it. Like him, there's a couple other like guys that have kind of branched out and are just putting different videos out. Like I follow a bunch of those, you know, just because simply I'm screenshotting them.
Yep.
And I go back later and watch those different plays. Like so people always talk about basketball is not, you know, not who I am. It's what I do. Like basketball is, it's who I am and what I do. Like I'm a basketball junkie. So like, that's why I said, like, I don't know if I follow like non-basketball like stuff. Like I'm just a hoop junkie, so that's all my life is.
Yeah, you have to be. I think you have to be as a successful head coach. That's the one thing I think you have to be absorbed with the game, by the game, in the game.
Yeah.
Three underrated NCAA coaches that run some neat, cool stuff on the court that you feel like people should pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. It's funny because like I watch a lot of mid-major basketball, right? I watch a lot of people that play a similar style than to how we play, right? So I think the guy Josh Schertz is now at St. Louis. I like them. He was in Indiana State last year. Now he took the St. Louis job. Like they run good stuff. They run good actions. UConn started to, they run long, like a lot of actions, but layered actions with movement. Like, but that's an easy one because a lot of people have watched them and have seen what they're doing. Trying to think of a couple others, like guys that we've played. Virginia Tech does a lot of like zoom actions in different variations. Mm-hmm. So, and they get to them in different ways. So like, if you watch them play, you think they got a million plays, but it's like, they all kind of end in some kind of zoom actions, but how he disguises them and how he moves different guys around to get to them. Like they'll be in the middle up the gut. They'll be from the wings up top. Like I like what they do and how they get to it. So if you really like zoom actions, that's a good one to watch. Trying to think of the third, like somebody else that does like, I'm trying to think of like different actions.
It's
fun to watch just because I watch so much like different stuff. Like, you know, there's not many teams that play similar to us. There's not very many teams that do a lot of five out type stuff or move actions around. So it's hard to, it's hard to find that in college.
But we can use UConn. I mean, UConn is a like people should watch it anyway, you know. But
yeah.
But
they're doing what their sets, how they layer their sets, how they get to different endings. It's almost like football. It's almost like football plays, and then at the end, it's either X, Y, or Z. Like it could be the same play, but it's going to end in X, Y, or Z. And they do a great job of disguising it and running it pretty fluidly.
Dinner with three other people dead or alive.
Three other people dead or alive. I would love to have dinner with Barack Obama. I just think like his so interesting and worldly.
Mm-hmm.
The Dolphins coach, Mike McDaniels. I just think like he'd be very interesting, like humorous, but also I think he's so creative in how he talks to his guys, how he motivates, how he coaches, a lot of freedom in what he does. And then I would like dead or alive, like, you know, I grew up a huge Tupac fan. So Barack Obama, Mike McDaniels, and Tupac would be a very interesting dinner.
That would be an interesting dinner to tape. That would be a podcast in and for itself. something you believed in back in the day and you absolutely changed your mind on that you felt like 100% right on and it's changed completely.
Wow. Like, you know what? Like this is a long time ago, man. I used to grow up, you know, how we grew up in basketball and how we warmed up and did things. Like, you know, I know skill is very important and trying to advance people's skill is like very important, but like, man, I don't believe in three man weave anymore. we used to do it nonstop in practice and we'd warm up and we'd do all this. And I'm like now I'm like, why are we doing, like, it doesn't pertain to the game. Like, I get, you know, you're passing, you're catching, you're working on different things, and guys are getting loose. So we don't warm up with drills like that anymore. Like, you know, we're doing skill breakdowns, or we're doing things that try and pertain to the game.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gotten rid of kind of warm-up drills in practice.
Yeah, that's what Shara's Fenerbahce coach, and I'm sure you know, and a lot of people in Europe are have been watching him, and he does a lot of 3-on-0 drills instead of doing the 3-man weave. Just do a lot of 3-on-0 that translates right to the game, when, you know, it's drive and kick kind of drills, and you add different finishes, whether the big man finish, or you finish with a pick and roll, or you just have a 3-on-0 kind of different segments, and guys get loose going up and down. You know, you have groups of three, and it's the same thing. It's just that you don't just do layups the whole time, you know, or shooting pull ups.
It's game like, right?
Yeah,
game like, it pertains to the game. Like, I want to practice the things that are going to happen in the game.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we warm up with a lot of things that pertain to the game.
Mm-hmm. And two more, best advice you ever received.
Best advice I've ever received is, just be yourself, right? Like that's, for me, that goes back to, you know, when I was coaching the first time as a head coach, and I didn't know who I wanted to be, right? Like, you know, I was trying mm-hmm. to be everybody that I had worked for,
mm-hmm.
But I wasn't being myself. And then going back, and that's the best advice I've gotten from Coach Stevens, Coach Painter, is like, know what you want to do and have ideas, but do it in your own way and be yourself in doing it.
Mm-hmm. And last one, Tim Ferriss question that I ask everyone, a favorite failure, something that you failed on in the past, but you look back on it and it's kind of like the biggest lesson you learn. You feel happy that you failed at that.
Yeah, I'd say that's what it was. My first job as a head coach, I was at, you know, IU South Bend for 2 years. And, you know, my first year we were like 3-28, and we improved the second year. We won 12 games, but we were like 12-20. Right. And I go back to that time where, you know, I always say it, I'm not afraid to say it. Like, I failed as a head coach. But because of that, like, I got better. I had to take steps backwards from there to move forward. But that was a, you know, life kind of changing lesson right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, 100%. Those things carry a long way. Yeah. Micah, thanks a lot. We did the whole podcast within an hour. And I remember in college, my coach used to make us run 5 laps in 55. Well, we're just a little bit more than 55 minutes here, but we did it. So I appreciate you. It's been great having you on and seeing you again. And you're just a great person to hang out with, talk to, and such an easygoing person, man. It's been a blast talking to you.
I appreciate it, man. And glad I could come on. And I hope people have picked something up from this.
For sure. For sure. How can people find you? What are Twitter and Instagram?
I am Coach Shrews.
Coach_Shrews
on Twitter and Instagram.
Perfect. All right. All right, yeah. Micah. Thanks a lot. And see you, everyone. Thanks for being here.